Hi, I'm Dan.
And I'm JJ.
And welcome to The Men Who Explain Miracles. Welcome back to The Men Who Explain Miracles. We are excited to welcome to this, our second episode, the wonderful Robin Stevens. Welcome, Robin.
Thank you for having me.
So, Robin, for those who might not know you or your work, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
My name is Robin Stevens, and I am a children's author who writes crime novels, specifically murder mysteries. I was born in California, hence the accent, and I grew up in Oxford, and I worked as an editor for a while before becoming a full-time author.
And you are the author of the ever-popular Murder Most Unladylike series. Could you tell us a little bit about that for those that might not have read it or come across it yet?
The Murder Most Unladylike series is sort of Agatha Christie meets Ina Blyton. It is set in the 1930s and it stars my two girl detectives, Daisy Wells and Hazel Wong, who go to boarding school in England and who set up their own detective society. In the first book, Murder Most Unladylike, they then come upon one of their teachers, Miss Bell, lying dead in the gym. 5 minutes later, when they come back after getting help, Miss Bell's body has vanished. And that kind of is the beginning of their spree of solving crimes. They have now solved 5 full-length mysteries and a 6th is on the way, which is pretty incredible.
For the first time, you are publishing as well. You've published this month a book which is not part of the Murder Most Unladylike series. Actually, this is your first. It's not a standalone as such. I'm sure we'll get into that, but it doesn't feature Daisy and Hazel. The book is called The Guggenheim Mystery. Could you just give us a bit of background, a bit of detail on that?
Yeah, so The Guggenheim Mystery is not a murder mystery. And it doesn't star Daisy and Hazel, but it is still a mystery story, which is very reassuring, I hope. It is the story of Ted Spark, and it is actually a sequel to a book by another author, Siobhan Dowd. Siobhan wrote The London Eye Mystery in 2007, introduced Ted and his sister Kat and his cousin Salim, and she always wanted to make that the beginning of a series. It's an incredibly smart mystery story for children, which is actually in itself an impossible crime. And she did want to write the sequel. She had titled it The Guggenheim Mystery, but before she could start writing it, she unfortunately had cancer and she died very suddenly. So the book was never written, and her estate spent sort of several years looking around for someone who could complete it for her. You might have heard of another project which has sort of been completed from her idea, which is A Monster Calls. Patrick Ness did that one. Mm-hmm. And amazingly, they came to me and asked me if I'd be interested in writing the Guggenheim Mystery in Siobhan's stead. And I said yes.
Was that a little bit terrifying?
It was completely terrifying. I mean, it was a really exciting project initially, and I said yes immediately because I'm a huge fan of the book. I think it's amazing. She basically got there first and did it better than all of the other children's crime authors who've sprung up since that was written. But yes, as soon as I said yes and I sat down to write it, I kind of realized the enormity of the task, because the book, The London Eye Mystery, is written in the first person, and so to write the sequel, I had to catch Ted, the narrator's voice, hopefully as perfectly as I could, which is pretty daunting. And also create a mystery as smart as the London Eye Mystery, which I really think is one of the best modern locked room mysteries that there is, basically.
It's a very, very good book.
It is very good.
It really,
really is. It's such a good book.
And I was particularly pleased to hear that you were doing it, because not only is London Eye Mystery a brilliant book, as we've said, but I just think the idea of Ted and all that he represents and his sister and their family was just such a lovely start, and I was sad to think that it wouldn't continue. So that you've taken on the mantle is really exciting.
Ted is the most amazing character in his family. You read the book and you don't just love the mystery, you love those people. And so being able to pick them up and carry on was exciting. Kind of giving them more of a story and finding out what happens after the end of the book was exciting to work out.
Because it is just the one book, there is not so much in that universe which is fixed. So obviously there's a certain amount of stuff that you have to work with. There's a certain amount of stuff that you are inevitably going to have to invent. How tricky is it to sort of stay true to a narrative voice which was not originally your own, and then introduce original elements into that universe that exists?
Yeah, very tricky. I mean, it was a bit of a mental balancing act because I wanted to show you characters that you knew. I wanted you to feel secure. This is the same story. It's the same world, but I did want to expand on it. I mean, I had a lot of clues as to what the Guggenheim mystery was going to be about. I knew that it had to be Guggenheim in New York because Aunt Gloria goes off to New York at the end of the first book. So I had my location pretty set. I knew who Ted and Kat and Salim and Aunt Gloria had been at the end of the London Eye Mystery, but the challenge was to sort of grow them as characters, expand their worlds, and take Ted. Ted is a character who has a lot of really idiosyncratic things that he's interested in, things that he does, and to sort of keep enough of those things while introducing new elements to his interests. That was something I didn't actually get until about the second or third draft. Really helpfully, some of Siobhan's family members read a draft and commented on it, and I hadn't really changed Ted's character very much, and they came back and said, look, you could give him new interests, you'd give him new obsessions, and that was how I got the idea to give him the myth obsession that kind of goes through the book, to change him as a person a little bit.
That was actually really I felt that was so key to him grounding himself in the world and you grounding yourself in the new world that you're
Because
writing.
Odysseus is my obsession too. So I was like, yes, I've got, because weather is not me really. And Ted is obsessed with the weather, he's obsessed with the math and science. And then I got told that I could do history and myth, and I was like, yes.
Great.
And
Oh,
yeah, then
that's really
that kind of made
beautiful.
Ted mine as well as Siobhan's, which was really important.
Let's come back to that because I'm really interested in that. And before we go deeper into your kind of thoughts about locked rooms and your own locked rooms that you've written, you did your master's in crime fiction, am I right in
Did,
saying?
yes.
What was the focus of your study and what did you write about for your master's?
So the title was, in the beginning was the corpse, and I had too much fun writing it. That was kind of the moment that I realized I just wanted to be an author because it was about real life Victorian crimes and how they influenced Golden Age authors in their novels. And I chose three crimes, the chocolate box poisoner, Christiana Edmonds, the Tichborne claimant, and the Roadhill House murder, and I matched them to three stories or novels. For Tichborne Claimant, it was Brat Ferrar by Josephine Tay. For the Christiana Edmonds, it was Agatha Christie's short story, The House of Lurking Death, starring Tommy and Tuppence, and sort of Antony Berkeley's Poison Chocolates case. And for the Roadhill House murder, it was Clad as a Witness by Dorothy Sayers and a little bit of the Moonstone, which is more obvious, but part of my thesis was Clad as a Witness is doing it too. And I talked about how they fictionalized those real things, kind of made them more palatable, made them more unreal, and turned them into kind of entertainment as well, something really horrible.
There was so much of that in the Golden Age
I
because
know.
we know obviously there was in Orient Express. There was in, I mean, I've just finished reading The
Little bit,
Scoop, which is based on the bungalow murders just
Oh,
outside of
is
Brighton.
it?
It's based on a real murder. A man
Yeah.
had a mistress who he was keeping in a bungalow outside of
Yeah.
Brighton, and she got pregnant
It's
and
the
killed her.
mumbles or
Jumbles. Jumbles. That's it. Jumbles. And there is so much scope for. It's incredible, you realize how much it was
I know.
based on real
Well,
life stuff.
they were all real crime nerds, which I think is really interesting. But that was what the Detection Club was. They got together and they talked about real crimes and kind of showed who was cleverest, who could solve them the best. And they were all kind of, it was a one-upmanship thing, I think.
Have you read the Six Against the Yard,
Yes, I have.
where they each posit a
Yes, I
case and
have,
they have the ex Scotland Yard
Yes,
superintendent?
that's
That
a
was quite a
Detection
bonkers
Club.
one, yeah.
That's
That
a
one, isn't
Detection
it?
Club one. Freeman Wills Croft's crime, he'd get away with that.
I can't,
Like,
which one was that one?
it's the genius one at the end. It's the last one. He would get away with it. Freeman Wills Croft's a scary man, dude. Like, he would get away with it. I'm developing
A lot
a.
of them, I think Agatha Christie could have gotten away with a lot. Like, she was
Yeah.
quite frightening.
But, like,
Yeah.
the way that he couches it,
Meticulous.
he would have got away with it. I'm
Yeah.
developing a proper love for Crofts as I get older, and it's just like, he would have got away
There'll
with
be some conspiracy theory that will develop soon about how he was Jack the Ripper or something like that, won't there?
I think
Because
he
why
was
not?
a
And it's
bit
all.
late, but
Who knows?
also Jack the Ripper didn't do anything on trains as far as we know. So
Yeah, good
love
point.
him, but the man did love a train, don't
He loved the timetable.
Anyway, sorry,
we'll
stop.
speaking of kind of these crime nerds, you write for young adult readers and for children. And it seems that there is a huge amount of detective fiction nerds developing amongst that age group. I'm interested in that there seems to be this boom amongst young adult readers for this type of fiction in the classic golden age mold where you write.
Can I just point out at this stage, Dan is not using the term nerds in a pejorative sense.
No,
it
wasn't.
Yeah.
I am also a nerd in that context. Thank you. Yeah, in that sense, why do you think there is this desire for detective fiction among young adult readers? I mean, your books have made it as far as the States now as well and being published over there. So there's some kind of desire for it.
Yeah, no, it's been amazing the way they've been received. I think what I've realised is everyone is just as weird as I am. I used to think that I was the only one. I got into crime fiction and murder mystery really young, about 11 or 12, which is when I started reading Agatha Christie, but I was watching the TV shows like 8 or 9. I mean, I was really young. And I think what I've realized is that all kids are like me. All kids have that like fascination with intrigue and mystery, and they're curious. Yeah. They want to know things about the world, and they want to know things about adults. And I think also kids are quite scared of adults in a way. They think that adults are quite dangerous people. And if you read murder mystery, it's all about adults doing the worst things to each other. And that is really fascinating for kids. And I think that the number of children's mysteries and children's murder mysteries even, like directed specifically to children, which is new and amazing, just gives kids the ability to do openly what they've always wanted to do, which is find out really terrible things and read really terrible, awful things.
Yeah.
But also, I think the golden age element of my books makes my books quite safe, which was sort of what I was talking about in my dissertation. There is something about going back into history and setting your books in a historical time or using historical elements to your books that makes them not quite as real, that makes them a bit separate from your own life. And I think the fact that Daisy and Hazel are 1930s kids means that they can discover horrific corpses and they can uncover horrible secrets and be in real peril. And kids can read that and be excited, but they don't actually think that it would happen to them. I think that's quite an important barrier between them and my characters.
That's really interesting. And I love this idea of agency, giving children agency, and particularly with Hazel and Daisy giving young women agency as well, in which they can explore, be inquisitive, and make deductions of their own and not just be ordered around.
It's really nice. I get a lot of letters from kids saying they want to be authors, but they also want to be detectives.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure we're going to have an amazing all-female detective force in about 15 years.
Yeah.
So long as they're not authors and detectives like Roger Sheringham, who was an author and a detective.
Yeah, sure.
Terrible at both.
No, they'll be good. They're very smart.
I love that idea of history being a buffer to kind of like the realism of murder. Does that mean, can I sort of extrapolate up from that then? Presumably, I don't know if you can talk about this, but presumably more books featuring Ted and this universe are due to follow.
It is not out of the question. I don't have any sort of definites one way or the other, but it's something that I'd love to carry on with. I think there's interest in all sides, so it's very possible that it could happen in the future.
Right. Yes. Because it's because this is obviously, oh, I mean, no, I suppose technically it's set 10 years ago, but it's contemporary.
Yeah, it is.
Does this mean that you would shy away from making these more modern books murder mysteries? And you would, because obviously the first one is a disappearance. Well, this, I suppose, this is a disappearance as well. They're both technically
but it's not a disappearance. It's a disappearance for painting as opposed to a live human.
But something disappears.
I think it would be harder, and I do think that that's partly the world Siobhan set up, where death is so important. I think in my Murder, Mouse and Ladylike books, death is a little bit of a game, it's a puzzle. I want to make it feel a bit jokey, whereas in London Eye Mystery, there is a possibility, not spoiling it, but there's a possibility for a while that the missing Salim is dead, and that is dealt with in this really heartrending way, and it matters. And I think that it would be harder to have like a flippant death in a future Ted book, just because I think it thinks more deeply about death and afterlife and sort of what it really means. And it needs a little closer. You know, the kids have mobile phones, they sort of travel on the subway, there are CCTV cameras and you know, actual physical cameras that they use. I think it is a bit closer to kids today. And not that I would never do it, but I think it would be a more serious proposition than me just, you know, murdering a couple more people in the 30s.
That's interesting. And I think there's something to be said for contextualizing the golden age in the age that it was written and now the age that you're pointing back to. I remember something that was said at the Bodies from the Library conference at the British Library earlier this year, which is a conference on detective fiction. Someone was quoting from an L.C. Tyler book, actually. Yeah. He was a contemporary writer and writing the Golden Age style. And it was about the fact that in detective fiction, people die for a kind of a jolly good reason, even if it's a game. And the sense, therefore, that I guess often Golden Age crime is seen as kind of cozy or something like that. But actually, if everyone on your street, saying during the Second World War, has lost a father or a son, or seen someone's body blown to bits, actually dealing with death and it having justice is very important. And I think that's what you kind of draw out of Murder Most Unladylike Again. It's that the death itself isn't gory, but the solving is so important. Yeah,
but it has to be punished. And it's exactly. A very just world, which I've sure tried to put into my books as well. I mean, I think it's really interesting in Agatha Christie that nobody commits a murder and everyone has to die. If you commit a murder, you will die. It doesn't matter how you die. You can die of suicide. You can die of just like falling off a boat.
Yeah.
But you have to die. And I think it's quite childish. Like, if you commit a crime, you get dealt with. And that it's quite pleasing in a way.
And that would be interesting then to think about how it would work in a modern context, because that, again, as I say, it was, the death is so much about bad people die, or people that deserve it a lot of the time, or that you feel as if, well, they're a jolly despisable person anyhow. But bringing it into a modern context, it might be difficult to place that in the same way as you were saying, JJ.
I always saw the Golden Age stuff as, it's almost like truth matters more than justice. So you say, for instance, in Agatha Christie, if someone kills someone, then you're going to be found out, you're going to be caught. I can tell you at least two Agatha Christie stories where the killer is identified but not apprehended.
Yeah, but like God is there to sort of gently come after them, which I think is really interesting, that you think they get away with it, but then there is like a wider machinery even than Poirot and Miss Marple, that the whole world is a just one.
It's a really interesting idea.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Next thesis on that.
That's your next. It's your PhD. Yeah.
Well, there's a very famous Agatha Christie novel where Poirot decides to let the killer go at the end.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine has just read this and was fascinated by the concept of the truth and sort of the accepted version of events that is passed on true.
I think that famous one, it's more about justice has been meted out.
Yeah.
In the
crisis. I understand, but you're right. There's a can of worms that I really want to pick at.
You are right.
It's a fascinating discussion.
But I guess we're sort of saying the same thing, which is it's a world where it's all going to be okay. Each of the crimes, it's all sort of solved. And I mean that whole thing about Dubbett Jordan and the idea of sort of the murder being a kind of Edenic thing where you drag out the murderer from the sort of milieu and then everything goes back to being nice and everyone else is like, it's okay because they've like taken out the rot and everyone's happy again. Which is, it's really lovely. And like modern crime, I think we've kind of got a more complex view of the world. It has become sort of what we sort of think of, and I don't think you can quite have that anymore.
There's a funny, in response to that, I don't know if you guys have watched the Inside Number 9 series written by Steve Pemberton and Rhys Shearsmith, who are behind The League of Gentlemen and all that. Two of my favourite writers. They write these basically short kind of terror plays, mystery stories. Not crime so much, but some kind of usual twist that's involved. And in the last episode of the last series that's just gone, it's set in an art gallery and a number of people are brought together into this art gallery and they're all from completely disparate and different lives. They've got no idea why. Basically, it's, and then there were none, but it's set in an art gallery. And there's a very strong reference made to Christie in that. And one of the people who were involved in the set of impossible murders that then seem to take place says, references Christie and says that there's a problem with a lot of modern crime fiction is there's too much murder and not enough mystery. And I thought that was a really interesting kind of observation about
That's nice.
The brutality of things like that and the more brutal it is, Again, there's a whole other PhD there,
yeah.
isn't there? Shall we get a bit deeper?
Should we get back on topic?
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Let's get to Impossible Crimes as
yes.
this as we've been skirting around, but this is what this podcast is all about. You have written two, I would say almost three Impossible Crimes so far. You've got First Class Murder, which is
mm-hmm.
part of the Murder Most Unlikely Like series. You've got the case of the Deep Dean Vampire,
yep.
which looks at a girl who can seemingly climb down walls and float across rooms and sap blood from a fellow schoolmate. And then the Guggenheim mystery itself, which I believe kind of gets less possible as the book
yes,
goes, which is quite fun.
Does.
So for you, where did the inspiration come from to write an impossible crime? Let's take for the Murder Most Unladylike series. It's the third book in the series. Why did you decide to do that? And what were the kind of classics that inspired you to create a contemporary doctor in mystery?
I mean, the book that most directly inspired First Class Murder is, of course, Murder on the Orient Express,
yeah.
Which isn't exactly a locked room crime, but I was really fascinated by the way that all the cabins are set out and how people can sneak in and out of each other's rooms, or they can't, depending on the way there.
Yeah.
And I also read, like, actually, one of the things that I was very influenced by is Jonathan Creek.
Mm.
That's sort of where my locked room mystery education started.
Yeah, mine too.
Mine too.
Yeah, mine too.
Thank you, David Van Wyk.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah.
What a great
series. I mean, you know, I'm Agatha Christie, I'm Sherlock Holmes, I'm G.K. Chesterton,
mm-hmm.
which actually I think quite a few locked room mysteries
yes,
there.
Yes, absolutely.
And Dorothy Sayers, but I
mm-hmm.
think I think probably Jonathan Creek is my locked room inspiration at all times. And I always sort of think of a crime first. I think of sort of the problem, like what could happen.
Mm.
And I had this very clear vision of people outside a locked train cabin, trying to unlock it and break it in, and it all being really dramatic, everyone shouting. And that was the moment that I kind of, that was the image that I took to create my thing.
And decide to run with it.
Yes.
Yeah.
The thing that really struck me when I read First Class Murder is how much what you are giving a lot of young readers is a real gateway into,
mm-hmm.
particularly, obviously, you name check Orient Express in the book, so you are giving them a gateway into Agatha Christie, who is, I think, probably most people's gateway into Golden Age
yeah.
detective fiction
yeah.
in the first place. Mysterious Affair Styles was published 97 years ago,
yeah.
which makes me feel old, because I remember it coming, I remember
you,
it well.
You
I
were there
well.
At the time.
I was. But a wee lad. So, I mean, we're pretty much coming up to 100 years of pre-existing Golden Age
yeah.
detection tropes and solutions and ideas and plots, and it's all very well known. I'm interested in this idea that, because you write so firmly in the Golden Age tradition, to what extent are you trying to avoid how much stuff has come before, and so you're deliberately trying not to, because you obviously have a very conscious eye on giving people access, giving your readers access to these mysteries that exist. To what extent are you deliberately trying to avoid things that have come before, and to what extent or how much of what has come before is sort of fair game for reuse in, you know, following on from this near century of this kind of thing?
Particularly as I guess a lot of the readers won't know anything
no,
about
exactly.
it.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
which is, I mean, that is really wonderful for me. I definitely don't feel like I can steal. I wouldn't ever just take a plot and put it whole cloth into my books. I don't think that's what I'd be about. But I think that the Golden Age tradition is really playful. I think that it's all about messing with things that have come before. It's all about reshaping ideas and taking things maybe people have used half of and using the other half.
Mm.
And that's what I consciously am trying to do, to take enough little bits of Golden Age fiction that a Golden Age fiction fan be like, oh, I know that, and then twist it in my particular way. And I think also, even though it's set in the 1930s, put a more modern spin on it in terms of what's possible and, you know, who's present than Agatha Christie or Dorothy Sayers might actually have done. But I definitely, I want it to be an introduction, a really like friendly, exciting introduction, so kids don't feel alienated by not knowing anything. They can read it, have a wonderful time, and then think, oh, I wonder what she was talking about those other books, and then discover them and feel pleased. But I don't want anyone at any level of reading and knowledge of the genre to feel left out. I'll kind of bring everyone in and hopefully start them off on an exciting adventure.
I love the idea of, like you say, like perhaps taking half of something that someone used. I would dearly love to rewrite the second half of Edmund Crispin's The Moving Toy Shop.
Yes,
because
I feel that.
Like it's a wonderful setup, and like the payoff is fine, but a bit of me is just like there's a more interesting thing that I feel could be done with the second half of that book. Because much as I love the book, I remember at the end thinking, I remember the first time I read it thinking, I would have liked there to be a bit more to it.
I don't even remember the end of that book. I remember the setup and how wonderful it was, and then my memory is gone of what actually happens.
And
because it's the toy shop that grabs you.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly.
It really is.
And I think that's why it's gone down in history as one of his great impossible crimes, but it isn't really. And then actually, he wrote much better impossible mysteries than that. And
Swan Song.
Yeah, absolutely. Gilded Fly. Brilliant. Yeah.
But I mean, I think that is sort of what I'm doing. I'm not quite, because there isn't a book that is just me literally taking an Agatha Christie and just, you know, putting my own characters in it. That would just be boring.
We're not accusing you.
No.
just so the lawyers are aware, we are not accusing Robin of doing this.
I take little things. Like I take the string on the stairs from Dumb Witness, and that's in Mr. Murder, that someone falls over a string on the stairs. But... yeah, I think I'm trying to kind of put it together in a way that works for 2017. I mean, there are many reasons why my main character, Hazel, is Chinese, partly because I went to school with all the Chinese girls. But part of it is the Ronald Knox, the 10 rules. One of them is no Chinaman existing story. And I read it, possibly misunderstood it, and just got really angry because I was like, why can't there be Chinese people in like a crime story?
Oh,
and
man.
So, Hazel is Chinese.
That is the most unexpected reason for Hazel being Chinese.
But also because literally a lot of my friends are Chinese.
Yeah. No, the first time I saw that in the top 10, I was surprised as well.
JJ is dead.
JJ's lost.
That's awesome.
I do think it's... actually, that was mentioned and brought up again at Bodies from the Library, and someone who was doing a lecture on Ronald Knox said the Chinaman idea wasn't no Chinese people, but nothing like this. And then they showed Fu Manchu,
a
kind of terrible parody
dealing with
of
a particular
Chinese
trope.
People.
But there is something. It's an imperialistic. It's coming from a place of privilege that just doesn't sit right.
I think we can all agree that the Golden Age stuff did not deal with too well with stuff that came outside of a very specific milieu.
Yeah.
And I think that there was a very specific type of kind of gentrified St. Mary Mead.
Yeah.
Servants are like idiots,
you know, and they often have physical problems, breathing problems and stuff. And you're like, what's wrong with all these? Like, you know, it's just they're such characters, they're not people.
The only positive thing I will say about Georgette Heyer's writing is I think it's wonderful that she titled the book "Why Shoot a Butler?" You know, it's like who cares enough about a butler? That idea.
Why spend time killing them?
Yeah.
Why not just fire them and get a new one?
Yeah.
And you know, all the women and a lot of the relationship between men and women and romance is a bit dodgy, even with women writing it. But like having just read quite a lot of Carr, women are like genuinely like there's something wrong with them. They're like animal creatures from like the myths of. She's like, have you ever met a woman?
Carr writes some fantastic women. I'm not having that. Carr writes some fantastic.
But I don't know. No. But like the main character in He Who Whispers, she's like. But is she actually a person, though? I mean, she's great. She's a great character. She's a great creation. Is she a person?
The thing about that is it's very much... I see that as very much the suspicion put on her because of how much she doesn't yield to what the expectations of her are.
But, I mean, you know, like, it is what it is. And like, there's not anything in the 1930s that actually totally makes sense anymore. But I think that's what I'm sort of trying to kind of gently... I love it, but I want to poke fun at it. I want to kind of problematize it a bit because we all have issues with 1930s books.
And it's great how, again, Hazel and Daisy in particular takes on some of those things and, you know, parodies or satirizes them. I think that's great. Your mysteries are beautifully constructed. They're complex and intricate, and I think it's proof that young adult crime fiction can be as richly dealt with as anything for adults. And I was thinking about this quote from Carr's final book, The Hungry Goblin, where he says, be fair with your readers, tell them everything, but don't tell them everything in a simple-minded way. First decide what the average reader will suspect, anticipate him and fool him. Then decide what the clever reader will suspect, anticipate him and fool him. Thus, all openly, you prepare for your thunderbolt at the end. So with that in mind, how different is it in writing impossible crimes and detective fiction for younger minds in terms of plotting, clueing and characters? How much do you feel you have to fool, you know, a young mind? And I feel you really go for complexity and intricacy. So yeah, where do you stand on that?
I mean, I definitely love trying to trick my readers. That is sort of what I'm really trying to do in the books. I want kids to not get it and then get to the end and have sort of gasp realization moment, which I remember having as a kid, and just, you know, it all slots into place. And I want to have the moment of, I didn't get it, but oh my gosh, I can go back and read the whole thing again. There are all the clues that I missed. So that's what I hope I'm doing. I do definitely play by the rules of fair play. I drop every single clue that's going to be important in the book, but I just try to sort of hide them in the background. They don't seem to be very important. People are talking, and they'll just say one thing and then they'll keep talking and that'll be the important thing. The only thing that I do have to limit myself on is sort of numbers of things. Like, I always go overboard, have sort of 10 suspects, and then my editor's like, that is too many suspects, and I cut down to 5. And I have, you know, sort of 8 clues, and we cut down that. So it's in terms of kind of, you're trying to keep it to a basically rational amount of things, because, and I'm going to be nice, mean to kids, but I also mean this to adults. Kids can't really hold more than 5 characters in their heads, but neither can adults. No. And that's the thing that, like, reading lots of, like, adult murder mysteries, a lot of time when I get confused, I'm like, who are these people? and it's because nobody, like, the adult editor can't be like, okay, this is too confusing, I don't understand this. But, like, when you're writing for an 8-year-old, you have to be, like, viciously clear at all times, which helps me understand what I'm writing, but I think also helps the story kind of click along and not to be too confusing.
In terms of then going back to the idea of how much stuff can be carried across from the Golden Age, do you think with impossible crime fiction, the additional complexity of trying to explain something which isn't possible, and then obviously you've given them enough to show that it is, do you think there are more pointers required? Do you think there are fewer pointers required because you run the risk of giving it away? Do you think the way you give that particular direction has to be different because you don't want to come back to something later that was not explicitly given? Like, how much do you think writing an impossible crime differs to writing a standard murder in a room where all the doors are open and anybody could have come in?
I think it just makes my head ache a little bit more. Part of what I do in the books is get the kids to keep having detective meetings where they lay out what's happened, which sort of takes them a couple logic steps further. And then so kids can be following along and they don't have to be remembering through the whole book. They can be like, they can read, you know, a section and then there's another kind of memory aid. So I think that's how I kind of do it, to make sure that even quite young kids can keep following, because they're getting constant reminders of what is happening and where they are in cases. But I don't think I make a conscious decision to make it easier for children. I just try to make it easy enough that readers almost get it but don't. That's the balance that I'm trying to strike. And sometimes I don't get it right at the beginning, and my editor, my agent will say, this either made no sense or it was so clear that it just didn't work. And then I have to go back and kind of rejig it.
The writing of lists to kind of go over the details that have gone through. But I mean, that's a very Golden Age thing. Edwin Crispin does that in Holy Disorders. You know, it's not necessarily an exclusively, you have to do it for younger readers. Sometimes you need to explicitly just set out for readers.
I mean, it's nice because I'm writing for younger readers, I can do all the tricks to make it really obvious, or not make it obvious, but, you know, make it very easy to understand, easy to remember. Aren't that too many characters? Aren't too many clues? But I hope that I have enough complexity in there that once I sort of think my book's about for 7+, after 7, anyone can keep on enjoying them. I hope there's enough
for
in there for adults to sort of keep being puzzled as well.
Reasonably sure we qualify as adults.
I think so.
Yeah.
I try my
Is
best.
That all right?
I try my best. It's interesting, actually, just again bringing up Jonathan Creek, in that so many people I know watched it as children or teenagers, young teenagers, and it appealed to them and made sense to them, while also appealing to an adult.
Or it didn't make sense to them, and the reveal was just like, yes.
Mind blowing.
The one
That
I was, Danse Macabre, I think, the one where the skeleton goes into the garage and it disappears. That was the one that, like, I was like, I love like drums. This is amazing.
That was the first one I solved.
Did you?
That was the first one I solved. That was episode one of series two. That was the first one I sold.
That is
fantastic. Wow. I remember that distinctly.
I think I didn't, and it was so exciting. Mm. I was like, oh yes, this is hard.
What a great series.
There is a fellow classic crime blogger, a gentleman called Noah Stewart, who talks about particularly detective fiction being what he calls a carrier wave, which is effectively, and I apologise, Noah, if I'm going to horribly misquote this, but it's effectively the idea that it provides a structure that enables you to deal with a lot of other societal and thematic themes inside of that structure as well. And I'm personally really interested in this idea, particularly how in Murder Most Unlikely and in this universe with Ted that Siobhan created and you have continued, crime stories used to explore those who are perceived as, scare quotes, different, because Ted Spark is obviously, well, he says his brain works on a different operating system.
He says he has a syndrome. Okay. It's never actually mentioned, you know that he's on spectrum, he possibly has Asperger's, you know.
Yeah.
Never described.
Yeah, Hayes is obviously out of her home culture. We've already talked about, you know, why she's Chinese, which I think is probably my favourite discovery all day. But, I mean, through getting involved in the solving of these crimes, they prove themselves to be, let's say, better from the people who do fit, the people who you would expect to fit more easily in the settings where they find them. How does that idea of difference come through in your writing? Do you think that's something which is particularly important, especially for younger readers, or do you think?
No, I do, and I think actually, especially children's fiction is a lot about being different and about understanding who you are and how you are different and whether or not that is okay. So I think that, I mean, partly it's good for a detective to be slightly different from the rest of the world, to kind of stand at a remove, be a slight outsider. When I created Hazel, I was thinking a little bit of a Poirot-style character, somebody from the outside, a different culture, coming in to England and seeing English society. But I also was thinking about me when I was 13 and how awkward I was and how different I felt to a lot of people. And I want to talk about that in the books. I think you're completely right. I think Noah's completely right that you can use that safe structure of the crime story to be talking about a lot of things, a lot of sort of sneaky, deep things about society and about culture and about who you are as a person. And that's kind of what I am sneakily doing. So yes, I mean, I think both the Guggenheim mystery and the Murder Most Unlikely mysteries are a lot about the difference of the narrator and how they cope with that and how they deal with it, or if they deal with it.
I think it's a great motif that I think, particularly with younger readers, I've just read the first Alfred Hitchcock and the Three Investigators book, and Jupiter Jones, who's very much the weirdo and the brains behind that. Like, I commented, like, I love, like, the entirely weird family setup that he has. He lives on a junkyard with his aunt and uncle and these two German twins who help out. And it's never commented on, it's never seen as odd, and Jupe is very much, he's the brains, he's the driving force behind it all, but he got this really odd existence, and he's made out to be the really lucky one, because, you know, headquarters is at Jupiter's place, and Jupiter is the one who has the car, and
so beautiful,
I just love it. I think it's such an important thing to do, just full stop. Mm. You know, never mind just for young adult readers. I think it's an incredibly important motif to kind of carry through.
Yeah. Absolutely. And again, it's that whole, another reason I love Daisy's character as well is again thinking about agency and just the pure desire to be curious about the world and the agency that you give them with in which to do that, both as children, both as young women as well. And what I like in that Ted and Hazel are both obviously don't fit into their respective worlds much more clearly, but then Daisy also doesn't, which I think is really interesting.
Which I think is something else that I didn't, which I didn't really understand as a child, but that you can have these secret differences that you see, but nobody else does, and you're hiding, but underneath them, you're just as different and weird and awkward and worried as the obviously different people. And that's kind of what Daisy's character is, that she seems so perfect. And actually, she's got a lot of stuff to deal with. She is a quite damaged and weird character.
Yeah, and even though she's so popular amongst everyone, she also can't be her full self. Mm-hmm. And then I think that gives more integrity to Hazel and Daisy's relationship, and that's the place where their detection begins.
They can kind of go slightly out of the normal world into like the detective world, and then the difference is great and it's really positive, and that's what helps them solve. And same thing with Ted, then when he's being a detective, he can be the best, and he's good at being different, and that's what helps him solve crimes.
And again, that fits in again with the impossible thing, is that how much different could a situation be when there is an impossible crime, something so difficult to understand, and then people who are out of context solving it all just, I don't know, fits together in a really nice way, I think.
I like the way in First Class Murder that I believe there is an implication that something has happened with Daisy's family in presumably the second book.
In the second book, yes. Terrible things happen.
Happen, but I love that sense of her being very deliberately displaced as well. I think that is... Yeah, I just really like it. I just like the idea of... Probably because I'm just a weirdo. I just like people being seen as weirdos and kind of finding their place. I just think that's really cool.
We're all weirdos.
Exactly, like, and that's the point they're making, isn't it? Yeah, is that... And as you said as well, JJ, it's important to... celebrate that in whatever context, let alone detective fiction, let alone young adult fiction.
We will be a group hugging at the end of
at the end of this therapy session.
I sort of have always had the theory that to be a detective, you have to be a sort of a surprising kind of person, like a fictional detective. You have to be someone who doesn't look like a detective. You have to be like a woman or old or fatter,
Columbo,
weird shaped. You know, like Gideon Fell is like weird shaped and huge. But possibly it is that child detectives are more into a kind of difference and awkwardness, and maybe.
I'm trying to think of that kind of book would work with a detective who was popular and was, do you know what I mean, who just was someone who fit in everywhere very easily. Yeah. And like,
but
if you think back over it,
yeah,
pretty much all of them are.
But that's what I wanted to do with Daisy. I wanted to make her someone who's a bit more sort of Sherlock, because Sherlock Holmes actually is quite good at fitting in. He's quite sort of, you know, sort of suave and like,
yes,
he seems like one of the better adjusted detectives, and I wanted Daisy to be a kind of insider character, somebody who seems to fit in and seems to sort of be normal.
The interesting thing about Holmes is that I think Holmes is always in a situation which is on his terms. Like, people come to him to ask for his help, and then he goes out and investigates the case on his grounds.
And he has to be in London otherwise he gets a bit nervous.
Yeah, I mean, he obviously didn't want to spend too long in Devon, and frankly, who would? but like, I think with Holmes, it's so much on his terms.
Yeah, you're
whereas
right.
With here, where you've got the boarding school, or you've got the Orient Express, where you've got all these other things
that are happening.
They're not in control of that. And so
in the new book, I send them to Hong Kong. Mm. So Daisy is a fish out of water, and Hazel's like, I'm home. And it totally flips the...
the synopsis. Yeah.
I'm quite excited about it. Suddenly Hazel's like in control, and everyone knows her, and she's famous, and it's like, just cannot cope with it.
Going back to this idea of fooling your audience, one thing that I was really interested in about your books is that you never let a situation... be a kind of situation where someone acts in a certain way, and so there's only one interpretation of it. So often from Hazel's point of view, she'll very quickly see something that happens, but then almost instantly say, but that could be a trick, or that could be something that you could spin this way as well. And I was really impressed by your use of that, because often I didn't even think of that thing, and yet you're committing to that. And again, for children, how consciously are you thinking about that as you're writing?
I mean, it's something I'm quite interested in, partly because there is such a distance between the way that the world is in a crime novel, which is very small and measured, and everything, often in crime novels, things only have one meaning, whereas in the real world, things have loads of meanings, and I'm quite fascinated by the difference between that, and you have to do that to some extent when you're writing a crime novel, but I like to kind of play with it a little bit. In the first book, there's a thing where they see a large footprint and they say that must be a man's footprint. And I put that in, it's not. I put that in because I have really big feet. I've got I've got size 9 feet. And so I know that if I made a footprint, I would look like a man, but actually I am definitely not a man. And it's things like that that I'm interested in, things that how they appear and how they really are, is something that, yeah, I like to play with a lot. And I think I put things like that in each one of my books.
I always love the idea of any point of significance as like a two-headed arrow, you know, and it points to what it should point to, and it points to the thing that you're trying to mislead them to thinking
about.
Great. I want kids to use logic. And what I love is that the kids who read my books, some of them read them with notebooks, and they're taking logical notes and they're crossing things out, and they're actually, they're sort of logically deducing stuff, which is amazing. That's what I'm sort of trying to make sure Hazel and Daisy's deductions are quite ruthlessly logical, so kids aren't like, but hold on, that could be something else. I'm trying to train the next generation of young minds.
And again, how Hazel and Daisy wrestle with those different things, in that Hazel feels things more keenly. She feels the responsibility, she feels guilt, she feels the deaths, whereas Daisy doesn't at all. And everything needs to be logical, you know. And the breakage and slippage in meaning, therefore, is interesting. Okay, so to round things up, what could you recommend our listeners in terms of your top three locked room mysteries, things that have inspired you?
I'm going to pick a classic one for me, which is Poirot's Christmas, which is one of my favourite Christie locked room mysteries. I mean, it's dramatic, the sort of smashing and bleeding and break down the door, and it's this horrific scene. I love that one.
That's in, I'm sure the dedication to that, she says, or at the start of the book, she's like, this is for someone who said they wanted a really bloody murder.
You're right.
Because she got too into, you couldn't even tell if they were murdered. So she's gone for it.
I love that one. It's great. And I'm going to do one that I just read, which I just already mentioned, is He Who Whispers. Definitely like having a car thing, having never read him until really recently. I sort of focused on the Queens of Crime. Loving it, and they're bonkers and amazing. It was a good solution. And then I'm going to choose one children's one, which is London Eye Mystery, and I didn't write it, so I'm fine to choose that. I think it's brilliantly thought through. Don't think you do better. And if you notice, the thing I love about it is that every single thing anyone says almost works towards the final. Okay, there's no like dead dialogue. There's no Ted doesn't look at anything. It doesn't mean something, and it's so clean. So I tried to do that in the Guggenheim Mystery, and I've done it to an extent. But I mean, it's London Eye Mystery is just perfect.
Yeah,
by Siobhan Dowd.
Yeah. So what about you, JJ?
So you asked me to pick three, and in true style, I've picked four to recommend to Robin. But I've picked them for very specific reasons. Probably not ones that people would necessarily expect. So first off, I've got Blood on His Hands, which was the first novel by Max Afford, who is an Australian author. It is it contains two locked room sort of murders. The first one is resolved in a way that has become a little bit of a trope now, but the way he explores it is very interesting. And it's from like 1937, I think, and it's historically really interesting, the mechanics that enable that to happen. The second one is someone is killed in a shop when no one is seen to go into the shop. And the cluing for it is just exquisite. There's one particularly just beautiful piece of cluing, and Afford is a very entertaining writer. And he wrote another one called The Dead Are Blind, which is, depending on your definition of a locked room mystery, may or may not be, but The Dead Are Blind is absolutely fantastic. The second one I've got is The Howling Beast by Noel Vondry, which has only recently been translated into English, because the impossibility comes right at the end. It is just this, it's just this wonderful, natural, organic impossibility that is dropped in you unlike in the penultimate chapter after all of this weirdness that is built up before. And it's a deeply odd book. It's an incredible book. It's an amazingly complex thing. Out of all this complexity comes this incredibly beautiful, simplistic, natural impossibility. Derek Smith's Come to Paddington Fair. Smith is best known for Whistle Up the Devil, but Come to Paddington Fair was his second novel. Again, it was unpublished until recently. It was sort of only a very small print run in Japan, and then it was recently republished. It's an impossible shooting in a theatre that just gets more just more, well, like you said about Guggenheim, it gets less possible as it goes, you kind of end up against it. And it's just, again, it's this very cleverly worked solution. And then I am a huge fan, I read it recently, of Bruce Elliott's You'll Die Laughing, because it's just really odd. And I think it's one of the, it's a book that is almost too fair play. It becomes a bit too obvious what's happening. But I just, it's one of those books where you just like, you start to get a sense of where it's going. And it's just a very, very odd book, but it shows what's possible inside of the impossible crime. I mean, I don't think, with the possible exception of The Howling Beast and Come to Paddington Fair, with the possible exception of 50% of the books I've just named, I don't think the other 50% are classics or would be automatic recommendations. But I think there's a lot there to kind of learn about what is achievable inside of impossible crimes. And they're the ones I'd recommend for those reasons. What about you? Have you got three to recommend?
Yeah, my three. I'm going to choose some weird ones, or maybe some from a little bit more from the background of impossible crimes, not the mighty ones at the forefront. The first one I would recommend is Swan Song by Edmund Crispin. I just think Crispin is such an underrated writer, not just for the impossible elements, which he wrote fantastic impossible crime short stories and full-length novels, but just his wordplay and his humour, I think. So Swan Song, which is about an impossible murder in a locked dressing room during an opera, and the first few chapters must be some of the funniest Golden Age stuff I've ever read. And it's such a simple idea, executed beautifully, cluing, plotting, everything is there.
That one would be good for me, because my next book is going to be set in that theatre.
It is his last classically good book, I think. Love Lies Bleeding, which came after it, has a very, very, very clever plot, but is not a good book. And then his writing goes horribly downhill.
It was interesting, again, to hear at Bodies from the Library how his life pretty much went downhill at that point as well.
Yeah, that's really
he
true.
Was an alcoholic, and he'd got, stuck.
They're all alcoholics. Yeah. Round car, alcoholics.
Yeah, they just got stuck in this, he got stuck in this thing of, he was basically a composer, so much of what he does is about music. And he ended up getting stuck in this, even though he was a classical composer, getting stuck writing the music for Carry On films and Fu Manchu and stuff like that. And I think he just felt cripplingly sad that he wasn't using his skills to what he wanted. And therefore, his book started to represent that more and more. And there was a quote in his final book about this kind of stupid old artist who's looking back on his life. And it's so, you can feel the biting. But this is the last classically good book.
Your memory for what was said at Bodies from the Library is amazing.
My memory all around is too much. I'm sorry.
Your memory is really good.
I'm not even sure I was there. You're just coming out with stuff I do not remember.
You were there in the row in front, two seats to the left, actually.
You thought about writing.
Yeah. The second one, I'm going to recommend you another John Dixon Carr, but under his Carter Dixon name. And it's one that won't be on anyone's top 10 list of Carrs, and it's called Graveyard to Let.
Okay.
It's the only reason I want to recommend it is it's just so much fun. And it's about a guy who jumps into a swimming pool in Fuval of everyone and disappears. And they drain the pool and he's not there. His clothes float to the surface, and then he's found days later, a long way away from the pool, in a brand new suit, murdered in a graveyard. It's just a gorgeous setup, and I just love the plotting. You could probably cut about a third of the book out towards the end, but it's so much fun. It's set in America, and it sees everyone over in the States, and it's very humorous as well. But it's just one of Carr's where he's presenting you with a sort of impossible scenario that's just so out of this world. It's wonderful.
SS Van Dyne did a similar thing, didn't he? Someone jumps into a pool and disappears. I want to say it's the Dragon Murder Case.
I didn't know about that. That's interesting.
I could have that wrong.
Yeah.
Read the comments, because people will tell us in the comments if I'm wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And the third one we've all talked about before, and this is mainly for listeners at home, is to go and watch Jonathan Creek.
Yes.
If you haven't, if it wasn't a major part of your childhood, go and make it.
Your childhood was awful.
Yeah, make it a major part of your adulthood instead.
Isn't it on Netflix now?
It is.
Which is delightful.
All apart from two episodes, one which is quite crucial, which is Satan's Chimney. Mm. Unfortunately, isn't on there. And it must be a rights thing. It's quite a crucial one
reckon,
in terms of...
Do you reckon Satan holds the rights?
Yeah, quite possibly, yeah.
That's
quite possibly. And then the other one that's not on there is the most recent one that was aired just last Christmas, and that the reason is because it's
terrible.
So recent.
It's we don't talk about it.
We don't talk about it here, but...
I have talked about it at a great length.
Yes.
We can talk about it here.
There's still glorious elements. There's still elements of glory in it, I think. But no, I can see sad
he's
expressions.
He's lying, he's lying.
I can see sad expressions
around
the table.
It did make me sad.
Lying. Do not listen to anything Darren says.
But if you haven't watched it, go and watch particularly series 1, 2, and 3 and be blown away by the solutions, the elegance of the solutions, the elegance of the plotting and the setup, and the great chemistry between Jonathan Creek and Maddie McGowan on screen.
And if anyone can put us in touch with David Renwick.
Yes.
Yeah,
so that we could interview him about the first 4 series. that would be awesome.
It would be a dream come true, indeed. Well, Robin Stevens, thank you so much for being
you.
On the podcast.
Thank you for
today.
Having me, guys.
Best of luck with book number 6 in
thank
the Murder Most Ladylike Murder Most Unladylike series, and amazing congratulations again on the Guggenheim mystery. Hope the rest of the book tour goes well.
Yes,
and,
thank you.
Hopefully you'll write another one in this series as
I
well.
I hope so too.
Hopefully we'll be back.
Yes, thank you. I can talk about fan fiction all
day. Yay!
Indeed.